Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program today...
We know the government mucked up on the JobKeeper program the first time around. So we know that they had projections twice the size of the actual program. So they do need to be watched pretty carefully.
We finally get to know the direction JobKeeper and JobSeeker is heading after the Prime Minister's announcement. Also on the program...
What it means is that now the Law and Justice Party holds the main positions of power in Poland.
The recent presidential election in Poland resulted in a win for the incumbent Andrzej Duda of the Law and Justice Party. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. But first, it seems as if we have avoided the short-term cliff that was looming in September as JobSeeker and JobKeeper were due to end. Question mark is still over whether the government will insist on lowering JobSeeker to the poverty level of the old New Start allowance after Christmas. Toby Hemmings asked Dr. Andrew Lee, opposition shadow assistant treasurer, whether now was the time to be winding back the JobKeeper and JobSeeker stimulus measures.
I don't think anybody thinks that these stimulus packages can continue forever, but Labor is very concerned that there's many people who are left out of the original package, and all of them are still left out of this new package as the government's announced today. We've now got a situation where for every job vacancy, there are 13 people who would like to take that job. We're in the first recession in three decades. So the government needs to be doing more to support people, including, for example, short-term casuals, arts sector workers, charity workers, who've been left behind.
With so much expenditure currently at hand, with the predicted additional $16 billion through this extension as announced by the Treasurer, do you think that there should be increased levels of parliamentary oversight for such remarkable sums of money?
Absolutely. Australia has never had a fiscal package as large as JobKeeper, and unprecedented spending requires unprecedented oversight. So it was pretty surprising to me when Scott Morrison decided to cancel the next parliamentary sittings without scheduling any additional sitting dates, without improving the level of scrutiny that's brought to bear upon him. We know Scott Morrison doesn't like scrutiny. Yes, there's challenges to be overcome as we look at how to get the Parliament together, but we have to ensure that Parliament continues to meet. Maybe we can get some of that through Zoom, but frankly, there's nothing that beats being in the room in the Parliament able to directly question the government on behalf of the Australian people.
Would you see that scrutiny role being undertaken through additional committee work or something more focused on the broader Parliament?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there'll be the additional committee work. We know the government mucked up on the JobKeeper program the first time around. We know that they had projections twice the size of the actual program. So they do need to be watched pretty carefully.
And given that initial overestimation to the tune of, I believe it was $60 billion, do you believe that this amount that was initially budgeted for should be fully utilised to help Australians who have been afflicted with the recession that's followed this pandemic?
Look, absolutely. We need to make sure the money is spent as efficiently as possible. Labor's been quite critical of the initial design of the JobKeeper scheme. We wanted a wage subsidy scheme. We called for it. We thought it was absolutely critical. We were pleased when the government put it in place. But by putting in place a flat $750 a week payment, what that meant were there were people who were working just a day a week as casuals who suddenly received significantly more in JobKeeper, whereas others who might not have been eligible but supporting a family, working full-time, didn't receive anything. So we need to be much more targeted about how the program's rolled out. And I think there's a bit more targeting, but not a lot more, frankly, as a result of these changes. I don't think the government has a clear strategy for what will happen to the economy in the future. You have to recognise too, Toby, this is quite different from past downturns in which most of the job losses have been men. In this instance, most of the job losses have been women, so we need to think about how to create jobs in the caring economy to absorb those who've lost theirs.
Speaking on that, now, as the Treasurer did announce, we do have an effective unemployment rate of around about 11% at the moment, and the economy is quite fragile. Now, you've said that you've been happy with the modicum of more targeting that we've seen from the package announced today. Do you think that this is ultimately satisfactory? And if not, where would you like to see further targeting occur, given your recent mention of the caring economy?
Other countries have managed to target their wage subsidies much better than ours, in part because they have invested in data systems which make that possible. What's kind of extraordinary is that the government that brought you the robo-debt scandal isn't able to work out what employees earn and provide a wage subsidy that matches that. So the data limitations have really let us down in this instance. We do need to recognise also that Newstart, now known as JobSeeker, is too low. We need to get a clear plan from the government as to what their long-term intentions are there. We can't have this notion that unemployment is some kind of a personal failing. It's simply not. There just aren't enough jobs to go around, and the government needs a long-term plan for the level of the job seeker payment.
I've just read that Brendan Rinn at KPMG says that in regard to the job seeker payment being lowered currently, that it should remain at a level lower than the minimum wage in order to incentivize people to find employment. Given the current situation, do you agree with that statement?
I don't think anyone's talking about levels that are above the minimum wage. People are simply concerned about JobSeeker being at a level where people are able to go about their business, where they're able to get to afford food, and importantly, where they're able to get to job interviews. You know, if you grind down JobSeeker too much, then you get to a stage where potentially people just aren't able to engage in that employment search activity. But let's also be realistic. Let's recognise that if you look around Australia at the moment, there just aren't enough jobs out there, and it doesn't matter how hard you look for them.
As we enter discussion periods about how Australia's economy is going to effectively transition out of this remarkable recession period that we are now well within, or at the very least entering, how would you say that the Australian economy should further invest going forward?
We need to recognise that adding to the debt means more interest payments in the future. Before this crisis came along, the Liberals had doubled government debt, and they now look set to be on track to triple it from 2013 when they took office. So we need to see from the Liberals a plan to pay down that debt, which, frankly, we're not seeing at the moment. We also need to make sure that we're investing in future sources of growth. This is a great time for people to be doing more education, given the state of the labour market. But we know at the moment that school leavers who want a university place will face the renewed caps that the government has put in place. That makes no sense whatsoever. And then long term, we need to be ensuring we're continuing to get the benefits of engagement, that we're not putting our head in the sand and turning aside the benefits that trade, migration and foreign investment have brought to Australia. Immigration in particular has been a massive driver of Australian growth through the university sector and the tourism sector. And so once a vaccine's available, we need to be very quick to ensure that the tourism sector is looked after and the higher education sector likewise.
Do you think, though, that conversations about the amount of debt that we're accruing as a country are effectively putting the horse before the cart?
You know, you always see this from the Liberals, where they say, well, there's a terrible problem with debt, and so therefore we have to cut back payments to the poorest Australians. If there's going to be a recovery plan that is fair, it needs to be one that shares the burden. Already we know that the most vulnerable Australians have suffered the most in the downturn. They're the ones who've lost their jobs. They're the ones whose kids are experiencing the biggest drops in terms of school attendance and therefore school attainment. So we need to ensure that the recovery is a whole lot more egalitarian than the crisis has been.
Dr. Andrew Lee, Federal Opposition Shadow Assistant Treasurer, speaking there with Toby Hemmings. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On The Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network.
The biggest unanswered question is, where is the money?
Poland has been in stimulus mode for some time, but in the recent presidential election, Andrzej Duda of the Law and Order Party held on to the presidency in a campaign that was marked by many anti-LGBT policies from the president. I asked Matthew Coote, Research Officer, European Union Centre of Excellence and Social Global Studies Centre at RMIT, whether the election win will give him a mandate to enact more change in Poland.
He won 51-49. He was running against Rafał Trzaskowski, who's from the Civic Platform / Coalition, so from the centre-right Liberals. The incumbent Duda, who was firstly elected president in 2015, they have 5-year terms for the president in Poland. He was originally from the Law and Justice Party, which is a socially conservative populist party. But when he was elected in 2015, he resigned his party membership to be at least seen to be independent, holding that very important position. So this was the second round. The second round of the presidential election was held on the 12th of July. This followed the first round, which was held on the 28th of June. So the second round, it was just two people left in the race. And it was a lot closer than people had anticipated and what the opinion polls indicated early on. Given that Trzaskowski came in to the race fairly late, he entered in the middle of May when the previous candidate for the Civic Platform stood down.
So does this give him pretty much free rein for the next 5 years?
What it means is that now the Law and Justice Party hold the main positions of power in Poland. So whilst the president is officially independent, they had the national elections last year where the Law and Justice Party won those. And so the Prime Minister is from the Law and Justice Party and they gained a majority in the lower chamber of the Polish Parliament. So they have that majority. They didn't get one in the Senate, so there's a bit of a break or a view on their policies there. But they have, in the main, they have these positions of leadership. The Polish president does have the right to veto legislation that's passed through the Polish Parliament. So if the Liberal candidate had have won, it would have been a bit interesting because he would have had the ability to veto some of the more contentious legislation that the Law and Justice Party have previously spoken about.
LGBT issues have been very divisive in Poland for the past year. The electorates in the West have broadly supported LGBT freedom, and to the East, some provinces have declared themselves LGBT free, and this appears to be supported by the Catholic Church. Was it the main factor between the two presidential candidates?
The presidential candidate, Trzaskowski, at this election, he's a former mayor of Warsaw, and whilst he comes from the centre-right, he's considered, in Polish terms anyway, a liberal, and he has been a supporter of LGBTQI rights in Poland and, in fact, attended a Pride March years ago. Now, that's been a big issue in Poland. That was brought out in the campaign. They were using that to attack him. The Law and Justice Party were. So last year, there was lots of debate around LGBTQI rights in Poland, and some regions, some towns in Poland actually declared themselves as LGBT free zones. It's largely symbolic, so it doesn't mean too much. The Law and Justice Party, the socially conservative Law and Justice Party, are very much against LGBT rights, and they have the support of the Catholic Church in that. The Polish society, around 85-87% of the population still identify as Catholics. You have to remember that it was about 45 years ago that a non-Italian became Pope, and that was Pope John Paul, and he came from Poland, and they're still very much proud of that fact in Poland. You have to remember that it was about 45 years ago that a non-Italian became Pope, and that was Pope John Paul, and he came from Poland, and they're still very much proud of that fact in Poland. He was very influential too, I must say, the Pope at the time, very influential when it came to getting involved in domestic politics in Eastern Europe, very much against the communist rule at the time and was a supporter of an illegal trade union in Poland at the time called Solidarity, which throughout the 1980s was very, very prominent.
But I think the leader of Solidarity, Lech Walesa, is very disappointed with the current turn of events.
Certainly is. He certainly is. So very disappointed with the way that things have gone in Polish society, especially around, you know, the crackdown on the LGBT community, the fact that same-sex marriage is still banned, same-sex couples are not able to adopt. But then you've got the other areas like the attack on the judiciary by the Law and Justice Party, the independence of the judiciary, the attack on the free press and media in Poland. So what they've done is they've stacked their own people in positions of power in the media. So, yeah, he has been quite outspoken about that. That's not the, you know, the vision that he saw of and wants of post-communist Poland.
Would it be fair to say that the way Poland's turning out is a little bit leaning more to the way President Putin runs things rather than Angela Merkel, if you're looking at east and west of the country?
Yeah, it's interesting you draw out that, you say that, because whilst the Poles look at Russia with concern because of their history, it was during World War II, they were invaded by the Soviet Union on one side, and on the other side they were invaded by the German Nazis as well, and that all happened in September 1939, I think it was, and by the end of the month they were occupied by both powers. And in the post-war period, Poland was really just a communist satellite state for the Soviet Union for so many decades, and so they're still, amongst the Poles today, they still look at Russia with some concern. They're very strong, very independent, very worried about the concept of invasion because of their history, been invaded by many European powers over the years. And so it's interesting to say that around Germany and France, because when you look at a map of Poland and you see the way that the voters have voted in recent times, national elections, presidential elections, there's a clear division within Polish society between the East and the West, and the East tends to be more conservative, a lot more undeveloped regions, they're not benefiting from globalisation as much. Then to the West, in fact, the closer you get to the German border, that's when you look at the results of this election, Trzaskowski did much better as you head towards the German border. So it's just that, you know, that vision of Poland being open to the West, being part of the EU. They are a member state of the EU, have been since 2004. But where does Poland sit today in Europe, in Eastern Europe, in the world? What's its place? And still finding its way.
Well, could this prove to be a bit of a problem for the EU? I think the Hungarians have moved in a bit the similar direction and have been a bit of a thorn in the side of the EU at various times. Could we have a bit of a block of thorns forming here?
Yeah, yes, that's a possibility, because depending on policy, procedure, legislation or committee that is being voted on within the EU, European Commission, European Council, sometimes the member states do have a right to veto and a right to block, and you'll have that the Hungarians and the Poles may work together to vote against particular things. So the EU is looking at both Poland and Hungary very closely and with concern, because you, as a member state of the trading bloc of the EU, the European Union, you do benefit from being a member by trade, free movement of people, and the less developed countries like Poland and Hungary, who are catching up to the bigger Western powers, the smaller countries aren't recipients of funds. So from the Europeans, so the bigger nations put money in to try and, you know, balance up the development across Europe. Now, they benefit from that, but there are rights and responsibilities that come with being a member state of the EU. So the EU is looking at what's happened in Poland, particularly around LGBT rights, human rights, the independence of the judiciary. They've actually, in the past, they've actually been involved in taking the Poles to the court, to the European Court of Justice over issues. And the EU do have, they do distribute the funds, as I said earlier, so they do also have that lever. And the pie is a bit smaller today. It's a bit smaller today because of two things: Brexit. So the UK was a net contributor to the funds of the EU, and now the pie is smaller as UK moves out of the EU. And the other issue that's happened this year is obviously COVID. And we're all living in a COVID world, and how much money will be spent will be really, really interesting. And
I was just wondering what would happen if there was a popular and populist Habsburg running around to reunite some of these countries in Eastern Europe.
But sometimes I wonder if some of those leaders think that they are. That's history is important.
Because it all seems to be happening, like the Ukraine and Austria as well have had a bit of a fairly right wing government, haven't they? So,
yeah, well, you know, they do have their other groupings apart from being a member of the EU. There are Eastern Europe groups where they come together to discuss issues. But there's that thing with Poland, for example. You're looking, you know, where do they sit in the world? They like being a part of the EU because there are benefits. Then they've also got their support being part of a bigger bloc because, you know, there's that big, big neighbour nearby, Russia.
Yes.
So they're always thinking about their own defence as well.
The massacre of K-10 Field is something that's still fresh in everyone's minds,
that and others, yeah. You know, that history plays out. I must say, though, another thing I should point out about the Law and Justice Party, I don't call them, or I don't define them myself as a right-wing party so much because whilst they are socially conservative, they are very much strong supporters of the welfare state in Poland. And so what they have done, they implemented this policy where they actually just gave money to families. Many people in Poland liked that, and it was a promise they took in 2015 to the election, and they implemented. So it's like, wow, somebody's actually implementing something they say they were going to do, and it was popular. Now, the concern I had around it was the ability to fund it. And when I was looking at this last year, I was thinking, gee, it's going to come to a time where they're going to run out of money. In a sense, things have changed now because we're in a COVID world, and many countries, and even in Australia, you know, are now handing out benefits to support many members of the population, and running deficits has become much more common.
I just was interested when you were talking there about the way that people feel about the east and the west of their country, because it's easy for us here in Australia, we're so far away from anything that you don't ever feel threatened much, but Poland has been invaded so many times, and it's a flat land with just a couple of lines drawn on a map. So easy to get invaded that it must be always in people's minds.
It is. And it's a small, relative to Australia, it's a small country in land mass, and there are a lot of other smaller countries around. But that history, yeah, is important. In fact, it was. I used that earlier example from 1939, and then obviously post World War II, where they were for decades controlled by the Soviets, in effect. But it was 100 years ago that Poland was invaded by other European powers, and that's something they still learn about in school. And it's passed down through the generations. But the other thing, too, is Poland was wiped off the map for over 100 years.
Yes, there was the three partitions of Poland, I think it was around 1795, where the Russians, the Prussians and the Austrian Empire all took a slice until finally there was nothing left of Poland. And I don't think the Congress of Vienna in 1812 made the Duchy of Warsaw, which was just a rump, which I think the Russians then controlled anyway. So I think that was that period you're talking about.
It's hard for us today, isn't it, to think back, to try and put ourselves in that position, what they were thinking. Having said that, news travelled a lot differently as well.
Is the economic situation going to bring down any government in the meantime?
That's a difficult question because of the situation around COVID. It's just so prevalent and just taking up so much focus and energy for all member states of the EU, and some of the countries have just, like France and Italy, for example, have just been hit really, really hard. So they're just starting to run up deficits now all over the place. The countries like Poland in the east there are very much a part of something larger, being part of the European Union. So it's a trading and political bloc, and it's a large bloc, still a relatively large bloc, even though the UK is on the way out.
Yeah, if you included the UK, it was still the largest, as a grouping, the largest economy, really.
Yeah, that's right. If you put it together like that, it's a large economy, and also a very much an advanced economy. So in many parts of Europe, not so much in the East, because as I say, it's only been since the post-communist period that they've been catching up. But yeah, lots of people, means people are very much very highly educated in Europe, and lots of disposable income and well educated, and so there's that consumer society as well.
Matthew Cooch, Research Officer, European Union Centre of Excellence Social and Global Studies at RMIT. Speak with me there. That's all we have time for on The Money this week. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well. Thanks for your company.